Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The fight over Donald Trump's travel ban has reached the country's highest court. On June 26th, the Supreme Court reversed several lower court rulings, allowing parts of the ban to take effect. It affects travelers from Iran, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan. Travelers from those countries will be barred from entering the United States unless they can prove a relationship with a person or entity in the United States. There's a lot of confusion about what that actually means. The order also puts the refugee program on hold for 120 days. Despite the fact that the ban is only going into effect partially, its implementation is already affecting thousands of lives. According to the LA Times, the ban leaves about 60,000 refugees that are in the final stages of being vetted in limbo. These are people who were supposed to come to the United States this year. So the question here is, who will be let in and who will be left out? And what does the ban mean for refugees who may not have families here in the United States? Joining us in studio today is Alika Vafai. Alika is a staff attorney and program manager at the Asian Law Caucus. That's a nonprofit that focuses on immigration, civil rights, national security, and criminal justice reform. Hi, Alika. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by David Murphy, executive director of the International Rescue Committee's San Diego office. IRC is a nonprofit that works on humanitarian aid, relief, and development. And David joins us from San Diego. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Alika, I want to start off with you. There's a lot of confusion about what is actually taking place. Tell us what happened on June 26th when the Supreme Court decided to reverse several lower court rulings. Because over the past couple months, we've heard about all of these court rulings, especially the ones that are coming out of Hawaii.
Absolutely. This case has been quite a roller coaster. And we did finally hear from the Supreme Court on June 26th. But of course, that's the culmination of litigation that started back in January 27th when the Muslim ban, the 1.0 version, as we call it, of the executive order came down. What happened was, as these various cases had been moving through the courts across the country, of course, the three most notable ones being the Washington around the first ban, Hawaii around the second ban, and then the case in Maryland, Ivrap v. Trump. As those cases worked its way through the three court systems, the district court, the appeals court, and both the Ninth Circuit, where the Hawaii court is, which is the middle tier court, and the Fourth Circuit in the Maryland case, kept the pause button on this ban in place. The Trump administration appealed to the Supreme Court and basically asked them for two things. They said, one, please hear this case. Please allow this case to move forward. And as you're making that determination, as you're assessing this case, please remove the pause button or the block that the lower courts have put on. And so what we saw on June 26th was, one, the Supreme Court did allow the case to be heard in the fall term, and two, they narrowed the scope of the injunction. And so in essence, certain provisions are allowed to move forward until they make a final determination of the case.
There's a little bit of confusion about what this means exactly, because the Supreme Court says the 90-day ban on visitors from Iran, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan, and a 120-day suspension of the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program applies to foreign nationals who lack any bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. What does that mean exactly?
Yes, I don't think any of us use the term bona fide relationships in our day-to-day lives, nor do the clients that I serve. The court gave a few examples in the case itself. They said, for example, a wife or a mother-in-law would qualify. But beyond that, there wasn't much instructions from the Supreme Court. So what we saw is an interpretation of the court's decision by the Department of State, who does assess the majority of the visas. And what they stated in the first 24 hours was parents, spouse, child, adult son or daughter, and siblings do count. However, grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, brother-in-laws, etc., are not bona fide relationships. We did see a real lack of clarity around fiancés, which initially were not included, but now are included in the bona fide relationships. So as you see, you know, as the days go on, we're consistently trying to both get clarity and also push the interpretation of bona fide relationship to actually encompass our families that are most closest to us.
Who is making these decisions behind the scenes?
So there's interpretations of the executive order, both by the Department of State and by the Department of Homeland Security, under which CBP, the Customs and Border Enforcement at the airports, follow. There also was some litigation by Hawaii that was filed to interpret the Supreme Court decision. That case has gone back and forth between Hawaii and the Ninth Circuit, and right now there's a question about whether the court will be able to further expand the definition of a bona fide relationship, but that's to be determined.
The Supreme Court is going to take up the full travel ban in the autumn or the fall?
In their fall term.
In the fall, okay. And what are we expecting there? Because as it stands, Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch, the three most conservative justices, said that the entire ban should be allowed to go into effect, but they accepted the partial reinstatement as a compromise.
You know, it's really hard. I wish we had a crystal ball, right? And we could assess what's going to happen. But the reality is we really have to see how this play out. So there have been so many iterations by the administration and different interpretations by the court. But one thing that is consistent in all of the lower court decisions is this is, in fact, an executive order that is motivated by extreme discrimination to a particular faith. This is, in fact, a Muslim ban, despite what the administration is saying. And they use national origin, they use country of origin as proxies, coupled with the campaign trail and the comments that have been made. There's just no way around it that this is, in fact, a Muslim ban that is quite discriminatory, both on religion and on national origin.
David Murphy, you're executive director of the International Rescue Committee San Diego office. And according to the LA Times, this ban leaves about 60,000 refugees that are in the final stages of being vetted in limbo. These are people who were supposed to come to the United States this year. So what does this partial ban mean for them?
So the refugee resettlement process begins every year with the president setting a determination, the number of people that will come. And that number was set for fiscal year 2017 at 110,000 refugees from all around the world to come to the United States. One of the misconceptions is that it's refugees that choose to come to the United States, when in fact it is then the U.S. government's job, U.S. State Department, regional refugee coordinators, to physically go to refugee camps around the world and pick those refugees that will be eligible to come to the United States. Once those individuals are picked, they go through a interview process with Department of Homeland Security, and it takes about 1 year for them to build up a case file on who these individuals are. If you clear through that, then you are able to go through the security vetting processes that are in place, which takes about another year, where your biographic data is checked through different databases, FBI, CIA, Department of Defense, etc. After you clear through all of these steps, then you are eligible to come to the United States. And so for this year, the U.S. was expecting 110,000 refugees. But as of yesterday, the U.S. hit a cap of 50,000, which is what President Trump wanted. And so there is, in effect, a ban on refugees coming to the U.S. now. But there was approximately 60,000 refugees from all around the world that have already that are in the final stages of this vetting process and are ready to come to the U.S. who are now in limbo.
Can you tell us more about the vetting process? Because that gets a lot of attention. And how, if any at all, how has that changed under this ban?
Every few years, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, FBI, other security agencies do take a look at the vetting process that's in place for refugees. They make recommendations, they make upgrades, they make sure that each department is communicating with themselves, like FBI and CIA. And so a number of steps have been taken over the years to improve the vetting process. To come to the United States through the refugee program, you are the most thoroughly security vetted person to come to the United States, period. The U.S. brings in millions of other people every year, work visas and student visas. There is no vetting process in place. And yet for refugees, they are already the most thoroughly security vetted individual to come to the U.S.
What would you add to that, Alika, just about the vetting process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when an individual goes and applies for a visa, they have to not only submit considerable amounts of information, but they also have to pass an interview with a consular processor, with an officer in place. And so I would argue that they are, in fact, vetted when they're applying for visas. The process is different, of course, for refugees, but going through that process, getting the interview, the long wait times for the interview, the amount of information that you have to submit, the different security clearances, even through that interview process that you have to pass, are significant.
Today, we are talking about Donald Trump's travel ban, which has reached the highest court in the land. On June 26th, the Supreme Court reversed several lower court rulings, allowing parts of the ban to take effect. And today, we are joined by Alika Vafai, staff attorney and program manager with the Asian Law Caucus. It's a nonprofit that focuses on immigration and civil rights. David Murphy is executive director of the International Rescue Committee's San Diego office. They're a nonprofit, and they work on humanitarian aid and relief. And if you have any questions or comments, what are your thoughts on the state of the travel ban? The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the entire ban this fall. Also, if you have any stories to share, if you have refugees who are relatives who are coming here, or relatives from Iran, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, what are you hearing from them? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet @yourcallradio. Alika, what kinds of stories are you hearing as a result of the Supreme Court's decision?
I think we're hearing a few different layers of fear, concern, and questioning about how this is applicable or not. One layer is, of course, family members who are abroad, who want to be united with their families, who want to come visit, or folks who want to come lecture, who have been invited by universities. How does this apply to them or not? Will my grandmother be able to visit me? Will I be able to come in and provide the lecture on, key topics that I'm studying? Those are certainly questions. How will the consulate be treating this? What will happen to me at the airport? Right? Mm-hmm. So we're concerned both about who this applies to, who's being barred. We're also concerned about any possible abuses of discretion that may happen at the airports or at the consulates. There's quite a broad discretion from those officers. What if folks are caught in this dragnet? And the last category, and we get quite a few of questions and concerns about this, is even green card holders or citizens from those countries want to know if this is applicable to them or not. We've gone through so many iterations of this ban. There's a real lack of clarity around what is applicable and what isn't. And you do see significant questions, even from green card holders and citizens, about this ban.
And how do they get answers? What is that process like?
There's a few different ways. It depends on in what mechanism they're interacting or looking for answers. There's certainly Know Your Rights information that we put out, that our core partners put out, that's available online. There also is a group of organizations that are monitoring the different airports. There's the SFO Airport Coalition, as well as 800 numbers to our organizations at SFO themselves.
Now, high-profile stories tend to get the media attention. For example, there's a piece in The Guardian earlier this week, it's getting a lot of attention, about an Iranian cancer researcher traveling to the United States on a valid visa who was detained at Boston Logan International with his wife and three kids. Moshe Danavi, he was traveling to the U.S. to work as a visiting scholar at Boston Children's Hospital, which is affiliated with Harvard. But when he arrived on Monday afternoon, he wasn't allowed to enter the country and now may be sent home along with his family.
Absolutely. What we're seeing in these types of high-profile cases is the problem with the underlying logic of these executive orders that really don't keep us safe. When we discriminate based on one's country of origin, based on one's religion alone, that certainly does nothing to keep us safer, and in fact, keeps out individuals, families who are here to contribute, who are here to be with their family, who are here to, you know, provide information on their cancer research. So certainly that is a problem. In addition, the challenge with these cases is also that for visitor visas in particular, the underlying interpretation of their ability to enter, their rights, there's a lot of discretion with CBP. There's a lot of discretion with the consulates, and things can become quite unclear. So I think in that particular case, we're also still learning what underlying issues CBP or the Department of State is claiming.
What about the stories that are not getting media attention?
Absolutely. Folks, you know, who have family that have visas approved that are going to be traveling in the weeks of the wake of the Supreme Court, right? Grandparents who are trying to come in, nieces, nephews, folks that are really unclear whether they will be able to enter or not, either because, you know, there are some gray zones with when visas are approved or not that may fall within what we know from CBP and from the Department of State or not.
What about families that just want to take a vacation? Because families from these countries, it sounds strange to have to even say this, but families from these countries vacation. What if they want to come to the United States for that, for a visit?
I mean, unfortunately, if they don't have what is the government's interpretation of a close relationship, parent, spouse, child, et cetera, if there are no ties to these types of individuals, then they will not be allowed to enter the United States just for a tourist trip.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Let's hear from Rudy in San Francisco. Hi, Rudy. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Yes, my mother's family came to the U.S. when she was a child, and they were refugees from Hungary. And I'm curious as to if you have any knowledge about the vetting process back in the 50s and or the 40s and. Yes, they came via Ellis Island, and obviously my family was on the Axis side of the World War II, which was an enemy, but they were refugees. And I'm wondering how the vetting process was for immigrants from countries that we had just been at war with. Thanks.
David, do you want to take that one?
Sure. And so the vetting processes were, or lack thereof, up until the last few years, decades here, was very minimal. You know, we are a nation of immigrants. That is the fabric of our society. We all came from somewhere. Well, many of us came through Ellis Island. And it was, you just showed up and presented yourself to an immigration official, and you were allowed in. And back then, during these times, there was a quota on the number of people we would bring in from different countries, whether it was Germany or Hungary or Ireland or wherever. And the current refugee program really has the genesis in the post-Vietnam War and in the late 70s, early 80s, when there were literally hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese coming to the United States. And that's kind of what has begun to that's the genesis for the current refugee resettlement program that we have today, including the presidential determination on the numbers that will come every year and the vetting processes that have been put in place. There's, if I could add to the policy that we're talking about here with the Supreme Court, there's a huge disconnect as far as what the executive order is trying to do, which is bar people coming from these countries, and having a bona fide relationship that you can prove. There are more than 65 million people displaced in the world today. Even if the United States was going to bring in 110,000, which we're not, it's less than a drop in the bucket. So we have to prioritize who we're going to bring in. So we look for those most in need of protection. Members of opposition groups, political parties, journalists, LGBT community, people that are historically or at greater risk in the refugee camps that they're living in. So we try to pick those most in need of protection. Those are the ones that the U.S. government deems that we want to bring to the U.S. through the refugee program. But They go through the whole process, the security vetting. Now we say, oh, and you have to have a family member living here. But that's not how we pick refugees to come through the program. So there's a huge disconnect in this policy.
And also, what about the politics behind this? Because the Guardian reports that Iraq was dropped from the revised version of the ban in March. The removal was reportedly requested by Defense Secretary James Mattis on the grounds that it, quote, might hamper coordination in the two countries' attempts to defeat ISIS.
Sure. Iraq was on the list, and now it's not on the list. And, I mean, if you take a look at where proven terrorists have come from, that most of the terrorists from 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia, for example. So it's all political.
In addition, what we've seen in the wake of Iraq being removed from the list is actually an increase in deportation of Iraqi nationals. There's some litigation happening around that aspect as well, looking at Iraqis with old deportation orders, and a real increase and a spike in immigration enforcement for that community specifically.
Can you give us a few examples?
Absolutely. There's just been a lot of reports of Iraqis being targeted by ICE, being targeted by different immigration officials, and an uptick in those deportations as well, which is documented in a few lawsuits.
Iraqis who've been in the United States?
Correct, with removal orders or particular immigration challenges. And so you wonder, right, yes, provisions of this executive order have been blocked and provisions are moving forward, but what are the backdoor ways? What are the other ways that the administration is achieving its goals, either through increased deportations or, for example, by changing requirements of the type of information folks are required to provide in their visa applications? Mm-hmm. For example, social media handles, 15 years of travel histories. All of that, since January 27th, has been expanded.
What about deportations of people who are from some of the other countries named?
Right now, the primary focus has been on what is happening to the Iraqi community in light of the fact that they were removed from those countries. But certainly, I think, you know, as we're looking at this, it's really important to keep a close eye, again, on key ways the administration is achieving this goal outside of the confines of the executive order itself.
And how large or how many organizations are out there working with people who have legal questions? Because there have been so many lawsuits by the ACLU, for example. A number of groups are involved in this. But what does that look like? Because you have to be available on a regular basis, and you have to keep track of all of the different pieces that are moving here.
Absolutely. This is an issue that impacts so many organizations, whether you work predominantly with Muslim communities, with immigrant communities, on human rights issues, civil rights issues. I think we saw over 40 litigations within the first month filed on this, not just by the ACLU, but Iranian-led organizations, lawsuits that focused on Yemeni communities. So certainly there's been an outpour in that respect. There are quite a few organizations that are providing services. As I had mentioned previously, a lot of airport coalitions, anywhere from 5 to 15 groups that are monitoring the airports, right? Right now, the cases have been kicked largely to the consulate level, which makes those airport coalitions have a different focus. But I think in the majority of cities, individuals who are looking for advice, for free legal services, for free Know Your Rights information, there's a lot of information out there and support.
Alika Vafai is a staff attorney and program manager at the Asian Law Caucus. David Murphy is executive director of the International Rescue Committee's San Diego office. And today we are talking about Donald Trump's travel ban. In June, the Supreme Court reversed several lower court rulings allowing parts of the ban to take effect. And so today we're talking about what this means exactly, who will be let in, who will be left out, who is being deported, and what does this mean for refugees? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about Donald Trump's travel ban with Alika Vafai, staff attorney and program manager at the Asian Law Caucus, and David Murphy, executive director of the International Rescue Committee's San Diego office. And David, I know we have to let you go in a couple minutes, but I just wanted to ask you, what else should we know about the difficulties of refugees who were supposed to come to the United States this year?
So the effect that we are having right now is we are splitting families. We are leaving tens of thousands of people in limbo. When you go through the refugee resettlement program, through the final stages, you're getting ready to travel. You know ahead of time that you're going to be going to the United States. You sell all of your household possessions. You clean out your house because you're moving, and you can only bring one suitcase with you with your clothes to come to the United States. And so that's what has happened overseas in refugee camps all around the world, is that people have cleaned out their house. They have moved out. They are ready to go to the airport. And in fact, they are not going to the airport, and they will have to now stay in refugee camps, and they don't know what their future is. And so we are leaving all these people in limbo. Another point is that what is the message the U.S. is sending to the world? That we are no longer welcoming. We are no longer welcoming refugees. We are no longer a welcoming country. This is really sending the wrong message to the world. We are a nation of immigrants. I mean, that is the fabric of what this country was built upon. And yet now, I believe it is what strengthens us as a nation. And so I'm hoping that calmer heads will prevail in the future. And then with regard to domestically what's happening, there is a lot of fear in the community. There's a lot of uncertainty and unclarity. And this comes from having a bad, poorly written policy. And so that is something that we want to have the Supreme Court take a look at, is that this is a very bad policy. And this is something that should be changed. And when you spread so much fear in the community around deportation, or am I going to be deported, even though I'm here legally, I'm a U.S. citizen, am I still going to be deported? So we get so many questions like this from people in the community, and it's really unfortunate.
The LA Times reports that the ban leaves about 60,000 refugees who are in the final stages of being vetted in limbo. How are they getting information about what's in store for them?
It's unclear to them. It's unclear to us. There's not a lot of information forthcoming. Mm. This changes every week. As Alika said, we're on a roller coaster. And unfortunately, we are on this roller coaster, and it impacts human lives. And for refugees, nobody wants to be a refugee. You are forced to be a refugee. And up until a couple of years ago, refugees always enjoyed bipartisan support. And it's just in the last couple of years with the political process that it's the word refugees, immigration, illegal immigrants, Muslim terrorists have all been combined into one nice tweet. And unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth when you have to convolute all those things together.
Yes. And how do these racist tweets, these racist comments from Donald Trump, how do they affect the public's overall perception of refugees, especially people who don't know much about how these programs work?
So now we've seen a rise in people feeling that they are empowered to speak out against refugees, against immigrants, against any protected class of characteristics of anybody in the U.S. And I find it very disappointing that we are now empowering and emboldening people to speak trash talk about human beings and the lives that they are leading. And we see it all across the country, where there are, every time you put up something on the internet, there will be a lot of trolls that just hit it immediately. And it seems to be getting worse as the months go on.
Well, David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. That is David Murphy, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee's San Diego office. They're a nonprofit working on humanitarian aid and relief. And today on Your Call, we are talking about Donald Trump's travel ban. And we're joined by Alika Vafai, Staff Attorney and Program Manager at the Asian Law Caucus. And now I would like to welcome Leila Khadivi, a novelist and filmmaker. She's the recipient of a 2016 National Endowment for the Arts grant. Her latest novel is called A Good Country. Hi, Layla. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. You are among a group of immigrant writers exploring how writers and artists can fight against these policies. Talk about the role that you see yourself playing at a time when there's so much uncertainty and so many people's lives are just in flux right now.
Well, I think the issues that David and Alika have brought up are incredibly important, and they are the actual facts of the matter in a time where facts seem to be in dispute everywhere you turn. What Alika and David are trying to sort of tell us is what is going on paper, in the world, at the airports. And as a novelist and as a filmmaker and storyteller in general, I think my job is to take those facts and those experiences and my understanding of them and turn them into an entertainment from which, regardless of what side you're on, regardless of what you believe, you have to listen to because you are engaged in it. And this way of removing the headline from the news and putting it into a story that kind of disarms a reader or a listener or a viewer is the way in which I try to understand how the politics of the world are going to affect people on a individual by individual basis, on a basis of family, and then how that can be related and sort of given a compassionate handling of.
Alika, what do you think about storytelling and the importance of it, especially at this time?
I could not agree more. I think that on one hand, it is so important that we pursue legal strategies, but legal strategies alone are just not sufficient. We need so much of what was just mentioned, right? So much organizing and work happening outside of the courts that is extremely critical to addressing this issue and really getting at the core of it.
Mm. Lale, can you tell us about some of the stories that you've written about this issue?
Well, I've just spent the last 12 years writing a trilogy about nationality, tribalism, borders, post-nationalism, as following three generations of Kurdish men, a grandfather, a father, and a son, in these various experiences. And in my last book, A Good Country, I'm examining the ways in which a child is born in the United States to Iranian parents and thus identifies wholly as American. He is born on the American soil. He has an American citizenship, an American passport, and yet is seen by the United States to be hybridized, to be Iranian-American, to be immigrant or brown. And the ways this affects him moving through the world, and in my last book, there is a scene that takes place in an airport where he is pulled aside because of his name and because of recent violences in the world that put him and the place that he is from under the suspicion that we're discussing today, and what it feels like to be isolated out that way, and how it tests your devotion and loyalty to the United States, and it tests your notion of yourself as belonging and as a citizen. And I think that in exploring this in story, I was able to sort of go places that the fact we're not there to understand. But I do know, as Alika was saying, that like there is a way in which, for example, telling the story of the Afghan robotics team, telling it over and over and over again, I think somehow finally allowed them to come to the United States, even on a 10-day parole, to make it here and represent themselves and the brilliance of their minds and, you know, the success of American foreign policy in giving girls access to science education, among many things. And it was because social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook had this story in its whirl that it kind of got listened to and got understood beyond just the, you know, we are going to build this wall, we are going to have this travel ban, we are going to exclude. And this is a way in which the story can tell people, no, this is how it helps to include.
Since you brought that up, let's talk about this because, as you said, it is getting a lot of attention. And this is a group of Afghan girls who wanted to participate in an international robotics competition that is taking place next week. And according to Politico, the State Department dismissed their visa requests at least twice. They cited privacy laws, but they didn't spell out their reasons for this. And then it just got so much attention on social media. And now Politico is reporting that Donald Trump became aware of this case and asked officials at the National Security Council to see what they could do. Alika, do you know much about this case?
We're just learning what's unfolding and the reconsideration, but this case certainly has been at the forefront of our attention. And I think it highlights the fact that, again, we cannot just look at individuals with a broad brush stroke as national security concerns, right? We have to look deeper, understand what are they doing, why are they coming, that there's families here, that there's so much more beyond just you come from a particular country, therefore you are suspect as well.
And Lale, what do you think about this case and how it's been reported?
The case of the Afghan robotics team? I think that it's a heartstring puller. It's got all of the elements to it that would make anybody listen, regardless of who you voted for president. The notion of these girls who are excelling in their field, who have been denied the resources that they need to build the robots that they would like to enter into competition, and so then use household materials and build an excellent robot that they send to the United States, and they themselves can't accompany it. And I think that what's most beautiful about this story is that the reason America is the country that it is today is because of its porous borders, is because we have had these open doors, and not fully open, but more open than most countries, that allow in talent. And over the course of the last, 10 years, when violence has sort of erupted in the world, it's not that we have allowed in danger in the same quantity that we've allowed in brilliance. And now, as we sort of close the doors to the world, the brilliance will stop coming. The talent will stop entering.
What about the political decisions behind this, Alika? Because according to Politico, in this case, it was, quote, determined that there was a significant public benefit to letting these girls in. So who's really making the decisions here? Donald Trump sees that this is getting a lot of negative press. And apparently, according to reports, he steps in and now these girls can come in.
Absolutely. I think that this is the piece that makes it so hard from a legal perspective, right? It makes it challenging from a legal perspective because you're not dealing necessarily with individuals who are physically detained at the airport. I think the administration learned its lesson by having the first executive order be implemented immediately, right? Where they saw folks who were traveling be stuck immediately. The issues have largely moved abroad to the consulates. And so who is making this determination is either consular officers who have broad discretion. And again, unfortunately, we have a policy where the underlying basis is saying your country of origin, your nationality is inherently suspect, which, by the way, is the same logic that we use for Japanese internment during World War II, right?
Yes.
So when you have that policy and the consideration is you're going into this consular processing meeting, into this interview, and someone is looking for national security concerns, that makes it extremely difficult to understand, to challenge. It's often not appealable. And there's very broad discretion under the guise, under the proxy of national security.
Right. So the Afghan girls are coming to the country, which is great and fantastic, as they should. And then you look at, for example, Somali refugees who have gone through a 10-year vetting process. And in many cases, they are living in refugee camps under horrific conditions. And they're getting media attention, but not so much on social media. Right? So what about them?
Absolutely. I think when we look at the six countries right now, many of those countries don't even have U.S. embassies in those countries anymore. And so the process of having to go to a third country to find the consulate, to go through that process, right? So many stories are overlooked, particularly individuals who may not have a strong, let's say, science background or fit the profile of what we would consider to be a good strong immigrant.
Exactly. Lale, I was just going to ask you about that. There's that whole notion of the good immigrant, the deserving immigrant that should come here. Can you talk about how you and other novelists, storytellers are tackling that?
Well, I think the idea of that, which was brought up by Dina Nayari in an op-ed in The Guardian a few years ago, she's an American-Iranian writer who lives in London, and she had pointed out that we are, as immigrants, supposed to arrive here and are supposed to come through that very, very fine sieve that David was talking about, saying that we pass all of these standards and finally we are allowed here, and that once we are here, we are supposed to only have gratitude. And I think the way the storyteller complexifies things, and writers, immigrant writers especially, is that they say, listen, we come here as humans and we will remain humans. And being human is a messy thing. And even though we have gratitude, we are also going to have our own confusions. We are also going to have our own missteps. And that does not allow you, as the people who arrived maybe a generation or two or three generations before us, to decide that we are not worthy. And what Alika is saying that I find so interesting and I'm fascinated by is this notion of discretion. And who gets to decide if the immigrant is right? Mm-hmm. Who gets to decide what bona fide means? I mean, in law, in legalese, it's supposed to mean without the intention to deceive. And who determines that? There's a Instagram group right now called Grandmas Against the Ban mm-hmm. on Instagram, who are these old women who I cannot believe don't have bona fide relationships to be allowed into the country. And yet there is someone at a border or at a consulate who is saying they're not allowed. Mm-hmm. Huh. And how does that get sort of standardized?
Absolutely. And a layer of that that I think is fascinating. I myself as an Iranian American, right? So there's cultural pieces. So our aunts and uncles are oftentimes just as close to us as anyone who is on the bona fide relationship list. And so the other challenge with discretion is it really doesn't take into account those, what is actually the relationship? How are, did the uncle raise the individual, right? Did it not? And there's really no way for that to be taken into account other than if there's a some type of a waiver process.
Lale, you and other immigrants are speaking at the San Francisco Public Library on July 25th. At what time is that event?
I think it's at 6:30.
6:30. Okay, great. Well, we will put a link to that event on our website. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That is Lale Khadivi. She's a novelist and filmmaker, recipient of the 2016 National Endowment for the Arts Grant. Her newest novel is called A Good Country. And today we are talking about Donald Trump's travel ban with Alika Vafai, staff attorney and program manager at the Asian Law Caucus. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can tweet at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Speaking of the grandmothers, we have an email from Jim who says, I wonder if the ban on grandparents will be lifted, given that it follows previous administration's limitations not to include them as close family members. It seems like Trump could argue successfully that this just follows precedent. This is one of many examples where Obama and the Dems have themselves to blame for keeping horrible doors open for Trump and other haters.
I would say that to a certain extent, we are dealing with policies and procedures from the prior administration that is being so amplified, so expanded in really extreme ways. So, for example, the seven countries come from H.R. 158, which was the prior visa waiver policy that was put in place by the Obama administration. But certainly, we have not seen this type of a broad executive order impacting those seven countries come down any time prior. So there is some basis of where this is coming from. I do think what we will see are attempts and arguments and hopefully legal victories around expanding the bona fide relationships to be more applicable and humane towards our families.
What are the major differences between the refugee program under Obama and the refugee program under Trump?
I think part of what we're seeing with the refugee piece, you know, and again, of course, as we know, not just with the refugee piece, but in terms of just immigration and the deportation issues, mm-hmm. right? We can't pretend that or ignore the fact that under the last administration, the deportations were so significant, right? That the communities, especially undocumented communities, were so targeted in that way. But I think what we're seeing now is focusing on even narrowing those caps, right? So reducing the number of refugees that are even allowed into the United States in that respect.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you represent about 40 people. Can you tell us some of their stories?
Absolutely. So since the executive order was signed on January 27th, we've either monitored, represented, and supported about 40 cases at SFO specifically, whether that be green card holders who were stuck initially, whether that be visa holders who are trying to come in and helping them go through the process. In the beginning, we saw such egregious cases. So one of the ones that we saw that we represented at SFO during that first, you know, 42 hours where the airports were just packed was an elderly elderly Iranian couple, grandparents, who were coming to visit their families, and they were held for over 30 hours. Wow. We heard cases of green card holders being in a position where they were being coerced into giving up their green cards, right? But even after that phase, even after the cosmetic changes that went in through the second ban, we did see, for example, visa holders not being certain if they could enter or not, students who were trying to return. And when you're at the airport, these people are really like our family members, individuals that we see on a regular basis, that are really struggling and wondering whether they can travel or not, whether they can enter or not, and what's going to happen to them in the future.
And the resources that are available for these people, can you talk about that also? And the difficulties in ensuring that you have those resources.
Absolutely. So we do have some Know Your Rights materials that do talk about the different iterations of the travel ban and the Muslim ban. But of course, what's difficult about Know Your Rights materials is the laws changing quite quickly. So I'll give you an example. Within the first 24 hours of the Supreme Court decision, the government's position was that fiancés are not considered to be bona fide close relationships, mm-hmm. and fiancés would be barred. Within 24 hours, there was a clarification of that position. So when you're looking at understanding what materials are, you know, what your rights are, the materials become very difficult to push out because there's constant changes. I think we can't overlook the damaging impact of lack of clarity, of being in limbo about what we can and cannot do. There are also several Know Your Rights presentations in person that the community can request from our organizations that we're happy to provide on a request basis. Those informations are available on our website, both the Know Your Rights and the presentation opportunities as well.
There's also an opportunity for people to get an attorney before they arrive in the United States?
Absolutely. So one of the recommended legal strategies is to speak with an immigration attorney before one travels. Understand, are they impacted by the ban or not? And also understand, is there a different immigration issue that may fall into a discretionary category that the immigration attorney can help you understand before you enter into the airport? So certainly speaking with an immigration attorney before traveling is highly recommended.
What effect did the protests have on this? People gathering at airports across the country so quickly and in such huge numbers?
Absolutely. Although we do need the law and the attorneys, I can't overemphasize how important that showing of solidarity, of protest, of resistance really was, because it brought national spotlight. It showed how the people actually feel about this, that people are not supportive. And it allowed that spotlight at airports and at consular processes where normally you don't have right to an attorney in secondary inspection, right? So there is this piece of not only showing what we stand for, but also bringing spotlight and attention so that any type of abuses, any type of violation of the court orders can be immediately highlighted.
What do you think people can do to build pressure today?
Absolutely. Support the organizations that are litigating the efforts. Make sure that your families, your communities, your neighbors know what their rights are when traveling, that they get access to legal help, and really uplift the stories, right? I think I couldn't agree more with everything that Lale had mentioned. And so uplifting the stories, uplifting the narratives, and really showing what is the devastating impact of this ban will all support in this campaign effort.
Were you and the legal community surprised when on June 26th the Supreme Court reversed those lower court rulings? Because the rulings just came out and the lawsuits were filed so quickly, and a lot of people thought, okay, this thing is not going to go into effect.
I think at this point, since January 27th, we've been ready for anything mm-hmm. and any variation. And what we're seeing from this administration is volatility. Mm-hmm. And so we really have to be prepared for any legal outcome. But of course, when you look at all the lower court decisions, and again, the Supreme Court hasn't decided on the constitutionality of the ban or not, you see very strong legal analysis that shows that this is contrary to the Constitution. This is unconstitutional because of the discrimination against Muslims and from individuals who the administration has deemed to be suspect.
What can we expect? The Supreme Court is going to take up this case, and we expect a decision in the fall. So what about people who are in limbo until then?
Absolutely. I think that's what makes the decision in the fall very difficult, is that there's quite a long time between now and then individuals who need to travel. And what we really recommend, and of course, I can't remove my attorney hat here, is to get legal support, to get free legal advice, and to find out if you're impacted or not, to know your rights, and to really monitor and be aware of the fact that, you know, we need to see what the outcome of this will ultimately be.
I want to ask you the question I asked David. What do you think the effect has this had on people who don't know much about the refugee program, people who might have a different perspective on immigration? What do you think this has done to the overall society?
I think our concern is, again, the reinforcing flawed logic, flawed thinking around that an entire country, an entire community is somehow more inherently suspect. Asian Law Caucus was founded by Japanese American attorneys who worked to overturn the criminal conviction of Fred Korematsu for not going into registration and concentration camp, right? And so reinforcing this type of logic that we should consider an entire community suspect is highly concerning. We also have seen, you know, the rise in hate crimes and hate incidents around high levels of Islamophobia that have spiked not only since the campaign trail, but since January 20th as well, which we're deeply concerned about the ties that this has to that piece as well.
Even in schools, we're seeing that.
Absolutely. School bullying is a tremendous issue.
Just quickly, how do you counter that?
There's a lot of different ways to do it. I think what's been really amazing, especially with the airports, is we saw such an outpouring of not only directly impacted community support, but allies and individuals that are saying, this ban is un-American. Islamophobia is un-American. And so really getting involved at the local level with local organizations, with different opportunities is a tremendous way to counter that.
Alika Vafai is a staff attorney and program manager at the Asian Law Caucus. It's a nonprofit that focuses on immigration and civil rights. Alika, thanks for your work and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about various public interest groups and several corporations that took part in a day of action to protest the FCC's plan to kill net neutrality. And then we will also discuss media coverage of the latest Russia-Trump scandal. What do we know? What don't we know? And a New York Times ProPublica investigation about the administration's secret deregulation task force, which has very deep ties to industry. If you saw a story this week that caught your attention, you can tweet us at YourCallRadio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. Sanaa Saleem produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.